From 1964, The Beatles, 8 Days a Week, which is also the title of a new Ron Howard film that was released a couple of days ago. It's playing in select theaters around the country for a limited time. I guess it's, I looked at the schedule, not coming to Las Vegas. Can't understand that, but I got to figure out a way to see it. We're talking with Stan Friedman and Kathleen Martin, and as we've mentioned a couple of times, even a casual UFO reader knows the term Project Blue Book, and you know that it was a study by the U.S. Air Force. It ended in 1969. It's widely thought to have been a public relations exercise to discredit the UFO topic, but there was a much more extensive paper trail that existed even before Blue Book came out. Two documents in particular, highly classified at the time, both with the same title, called Estimates of the Situation. Basically, the military took a look at the UFO evidence at that time. The first estimate of the situation said, this is real. It's not something that was made up. It's not fictitious. It's real. Something really is flying around up there. How that document and the subsequent document with the same title became muddled, how they became discredited in the eyes of people in my line of work or scientists, is a story in and of itself. And we're going to jump into that right after this on Coast to Coast AM. You know, I guess the significance of government documents, even documents that are old by modern standards, dating back to the 40s and 50s, the significance is that our military and intelligence agencies, they're the ones who have the capability to collect the data, the evidence on something as big as this topic. They have the sensors, they have satellites, they have radar systems, they have personnel all over the place. It's their job to evaluate threats to protect the public. So they're the guys and gals who would whose job it would be to presumably take a look at this threat and evaluate it. And in the early days, before FOIA existed, the comments were much more candid behind closed doors. Stan, I wonder if you could address the estimates of the situation, those two documents, the early days, and what the significance of those documents are, what they said.
Well, we didn't find out the full significance until much later when we heard from General Carol Bolander, because one would think that the most important sightings are those that affect the military. You know, if an airplane gets blotted out of the sky and that sort of thing, that's a big deal. But a guy named Bob Todd, who made over 1,000 Freedom of Information Act requests a number of years ago, in the pile of documents that he got as a result of a bunch of requests, we have a statement from General Carol Bolander. He was an Air Force general, an engineer on the Lunar Excursion Module, and not involved with Blue Book at all, but he was asked to evaluate what should the Air Force do about Project Blue Book, because the University of Colorado study, the so-called Condon Report, had recommended that it be closed because it really wasn't contributing anything to intelligence or national defense or stuff like that. So he came at it fresh, and he wrote a memo, which we didn't see until 10 years later. That's when Bob got it, Bob Todd, in which it said, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. That's a shocker. And then two paragraphs later, he says that Blue Book, if the public is denied access to Blue Book, that is, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures designed for that purpose. Now, that's a shocking statement, since the Air Force has consistently said, since Blue Book was closed, that there was no national security aspect of this. Don't worry about it, folks. Nothing going on here. And I managed to locate General Bolander. You can't have him as a guest, George, because he's dead. At least I don't know how to reach across that barrier. But
we're working on it. Yeah.
Okay. And I asked him, I said, it sounds to me like you're saying there are two separate communication channels. I had told them that I had had a clearance and was very interested in UFOs and so forth. And I said, if it's a report for national security, and I had just heard one a couple of weeks before that, somebody telling me about a saucer going down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons were stored. And I said, by definition, I presume that's a concern for national security. And he agreed. I said, on the other hand, if my wife and I are driving down the road and see a saucer fly over, big deal, it happens all the time. He agreed. Two separate channels of communication. And the question, of course, is where did the ones that could affect national security go? And I believe the answer, of course, is Operation Majestic 12, which we didn't know anything at all about at that time. So the Bolander memo, to me, is an extraordinarily important memo. Because, as you just said, the guys who have the equipment, the manpower, the opportunity to observe UFOs, satellites, airplanes chasing UFOs, etc., radar installations all over the place, including at sea, that's all government. I don't, Kathy and I don't have our own radar set. Wouldn't that be neat? But so the kicker is that we haven't. That's the first memo that I've seen that makes it so explicit that this very important category of UFO sightings, those which could affect national security, are not part of the Blue Book system. How could that be? But that's the way it was. That's from government documents themselves.
That's pretty big. I mean, it means, it suggests that somewhere there's a big pile of information about the most exciting, threatening and dangerous cases, and we've never seen, it's never seen a light of day.
That's right. And that shocked me. I mean, it didn't surprise me in a sense that I've had enough experience with government to know that secrets can be kept. But a blatant statement about reports which could affect national security aren't part of the Blue Book system. I thought that's what Blue Book was for. You know?
Well, before Blue Book, of course, there was Sign and Grudge, and as I mentioned in the break, there was an estimate of the situation that was written by Project Sign's staff. That report was dropped on the desk of General Hoyt Vandenberg.
Yes.
And what did he do with it?
He said there isn't enough evidence to support this conclusion.
The conclusion was what?
That these things seem to be real and possibly of extraterrestrial nature. And one must note that Vandenberg was also a part of this Operation Majestic 12. He had a distinguished career, and he also had a relative who was a senator and all that sort of thing. But in other words, the secret side of the coin just hasn't been demonstrated for the public. And, you know, we got the Washington Post going crazy about Watergate. Got the New York Times about, what was the other thing, that Vietnam and all that sort of stuff. And yet nobody has looked at this. And we've all been convinced, or the guys in the Third Estate, I guess, have been convinced that there's no point in going after this stuff because there's nothing there. And now we know there was something there. And that was shocking even to me. So
Kathleen, you're familiar with the Blue Book, of course. You were mentioning about some of the documents relating to your aunt, Betty Hill. Yeah. After Project Sign, which we were just talking about, this report goes to General Hoyt Vandenberg. He says, I'm not going to sign off on this. His staff gets the message that anything that says UFOs are real and from somewhere else isn't going to fly. So Project Sign becomes Project Grudge. They write a very dismissive report. And later, Project Blue Book is a different animal altogether. It seems to be a PR exercise that really does go out of its way to try to explain away all these UFO reports. Despite the fact that that seemed to be its mission, there remains a pretty big chunk of cases that could not be explained away and which have not been treated fairly, Betty Hill's and Barney Hill's case being one of them. Do you want to address that for a little bit about... Because, I mean, a lot of people have a totally different impression about what Blue Book did, what its importance is, what the final conclusions were.
Well, I want to say first that Project Sign was not just a small project. 243 cases were analyzed and evaluated. This was done systematically and in great detail. And in the end, the ET hypothesis was favored. This happened earlier. It seemed that going back all the way to the studies that were done as far back as 1946, the consensus was that these appeared to be craft that were not of Earth origin. They initially wondered if it was the Soviet Union. We had a lot of people looking at the Soviet Union with their early ghost rockets. And in some cases, they found that it was Soviet rockets. They were able to analyze the debris that they discovered. But in other cases that involved landed craft with sometimes beings in proximity to the craft, they simply couldn't explain it. So it seems that we have initially the Army Air Force going back and forth from we think it's extraterrestrial, we don't believe that it's from the Earth, to then closing down Project Sign, and in February of 49, opening up Project Grudge, where we had two lower-ranking military officers. Everyone else was dismissed. And all they did is they had the simple task of assigning scientific explanations to what the cases that Project Sign had evaluated but couldn't explain. And on the quarter that defied explanation, they found psychologists who were able to attribute them to psychological causes. And obviously, Project Sign, that went into this in great detail, did not think that they were caused by psychological causes. I was very interested at the beginning of Project Blue Book because it seemed to be serious when Captain Edward Ruppelt took over. It seemed that it was shifting back to the kind of committee that Project Sign had been. They were taking cases seriously. At that point, 1,593 cases had been investigated, and the committee had attempted to place them into various categories of having prosaic explanations, such as balloons or conventional aircraft or astronomical bodies.
Swamp gas.
That sort of thing. Insufficient data. But still, in 1952, 26.94%, almost 27%, fit into the unknown category. And that was extremely interesting. And it wasn't until after 1953, when the Robertson panel met, the CIA-funded Robertson panel, who had looked at some of the Air Force's files, that everything seemed to change from the research that I have done, and I've taken a particular interest in these early cases. And that is when Captain Edward Ruppelt stepped down, and he was replaced by Officer Hardin, who took a very skeptical view of this and didn't take it seriously and was explaining away case after case. We also know that some directives were put in. There were changes in U.S. Air Force policy. For one thing, it was Air Force Regulation 200-2 that Project Blue Book will inform the news media on UFOs only when they had been positively identified as familiar objects. And then Stan had mentioned JNAP 146, where it became a crime for military personnel to discuss classified UFO reports with unauthorized people, and faced fines of up to 2 years in prison, and or faced up to 2 years in prison and fines of up to $10,000. So there were going to be very serious consequences. That is really an indication of the beginning of the lid clamping down and the cover-up going into full swing.
Yeah, I've never heard a good response from the debunkers or the disinformation folks about those two regulations you mentioned, about when the Air Force makes it a crime, or the military makes it a crime for any personnel to publicly discuss a UFO incident, and a policy to only release information about UFO cases when you got a good explanation. I mean, it's hard to come back to that. Stan, you've grappled with this for a long time with your fellow scientists who say there is no scientific evidence that any of this is legitimate. And yet the largest studies that have been done by our government, which did their best to wipe it away, failed to do it. They came up with evidence that even they could not refute. The same has happened with other governments around the world. We know Russian classified documents show they did the same thing on an even larger scale. That in fact confirmed their worst fears, that this stuff was real. So there is scientific evidence if people want to take a look at it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important point, George, that I was shocked. And as I say, what really got me into the seriously trying to find out what was going on was to find out that the Secretary of the Air Force lied about Blue Book Special Report 14. And interesting about that, can you believe that no newsman followed up on that? The press release about that, 1955, covering 3,201 cases, the press release made it appear as if there was nothing to this, but it didn't give the title of the report. Surely a newsman, if he'd heard Blue Book Special Report 14, wait a minute, what happened to 1 through 13? They were all classified, as it happened. It didn't quote from more than 100 tables, charts, graphs, maps of real data. And remember, the real question is not, are all UFOs alien spacecraft? The question is, are any? Now, a medical researcher doesn't expect that all the drugs he tries to look at for various diseases are going to work. All he wants is one or two, you know. And so they got away with bloody murder. The fact that the work was done in that study by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, which is a huge research and development firm, and I had some dealings with them years ago, they're not even mentioned in the press release. And yet, apparently, nobody went after it, because I've looked at some coverage of the actual press coverage in 1955, and doesn't say who did the work, doesn't say where it was done, and doesn't give a true picture of the results. And they got away with it. And that's the distressing part. You know, where was the Third Estate? it's a shocker to many people, because they live in a world in which they think we can trust the government after all, right after World War II. They saved us from the Nazis and you know, all the propaganda. I don't need to tell you about that. And yet here we find that they're dissimulating. Is that a good way to say lying?
Sure.
A polite way to say it. And nobody went after it. And part of that, we haven't mentioned the Church Committee, but Congress took a look at the connection between the CIA and the media, the press, and found hundreds of reporters who were working on the side for the CIA, some of them openly, that is, the management of that particular press group, knew about it. And they were contributing to the national security by having their reporters help the CIA. And that shocked a lot of people in the 70s when that finally came out. But nobody followed up with regard to UFOs to the next logical step was, there are some military implications of UFOs after all. Roswell, or any of the crashes, Aztec, Plains of San Augustine, all of these have the potential for providing information that's useful from a military viewpoint. How do the darn things work? What new materials can we go after? You know, and we heard nothing about any of this.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about media, my colleagues, and why they have not followed up on this, because it befuddles me as well. It's such an important story and such a great story, and one that the public wants to know about. So we're going to get into that, and then we're going to get into the debunkers, some who are long gone, some who maybe are still around. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. Into the break with Guess Who. Don Henley, The Last Worthless Evening. Is it possible that song came out in 1989? End of the Innocence is the album. Man, that Still sounds good, but that seems like a long time ago. We're talking with Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin about Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, their new book. In it, they lay out the case of how the waters were muddied, how this topic was discredited in the eyes of scientists and journalists, how the paradigm was sort of attacked, and how the ridicule factor was created. This was not an accident. It was a step-by-step process, and the book sort of lays out the case of how it was done. Plus, it names the names of the people who did it. And when we come back, we're going to get into some of those names. Stick around. Kathleen Martin, in the new book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, you and your colleague Stanton Friedman sort of lay out the case of how the waters were muddied. And it certainly doesn't seem like it was an accident. You know, the idea of creating a ridicule curtain, so to speak, and to embarrass and intimidate witnesses and investigators and organizations who might be interested in pursuing the mystery was on purpose. Could you sort of summarize what the paper trail shows, and then we'll get into who some of the personalities and activists were?
Yes, one of the very, very interesting early meetings on this took place at the Pentagon in May of 1952. And this is when Dr. Donald Menzel met with officers at the military officers at the Pentagon, and he was dead set on the idea that all of this needed to be debunked. And it appears that his plan was to do this through logical deduction and the use of misinformation. And he went into this Pentagon meeting and he talked about how he'd done a few elementary experiments using liquids of different densities, and that he could solve the Air Force's problem by doing this. So, you know, here we have the Air Force that was taking a serious look at this in 1952, and Donald Menzel steps in. It seems like a plan was already in the works, and I know that the CIA was involved at that time. The paper trail shows that there were many, many meetings with the CIA to try to figure this out. And oftentimes, the CIA came to believe that it was probably extraterrestrial craft, that it didn't appear to come from this country. But they were also very, very concerned that the Soviet Union could plan a preemptive strike against the United States, and that Soviet sympathizers in the United States might call in and clog up the phone lines stating that they were observing UFOs. Other people would be out believing they were seeing UFOs as well, and that it would cripple our defenses. And so that was presented as a reason that this needed to be covered up. But what was interesting is that in May of 1952, the military officers at the Pentagon asked Menzel why he thought that a few elementary experiments could prove anything. And he seemed to be a little hot under the collar about that. He changed the subject and he said, well, hoaxes play a large part in UFO sightings. And the military officers said, spoke back to him, and they said, well, it's only 2%. It was actually a little less than 2% that were deemed hoaxes. And so Menzel at that time said that he wanted their endorsement because he had written articles for Time and Look, and he wanted their endorsement of his conclusions that were actually misinformation, disinformation. And so General William Garland spoke up and refused to blindly endorse Menzel's few simple theories. And to that, he blew his stack. He was speaking very authoritatively to these military officers. And then he turned around and he offered to be an unpaid consultant to Project Blue Book. Well, that was turned down in that time frame, as far as I can tell. Certainly, Edward Ruppelt turned that down. But then later on, into the 1960s, especially when Hector Quintanilla was the director of Project Blue Book, we find that Menzel was an unpaid consultant to Project Blue Book. So it becomes very complicated. We see these different individuals, such as Menzel, showing up time and time again at these meetings, and it seems that their purpose is to dissuade the Air Force, who is taking a serious interest in the study of UFOs, away from that and to work on a cover-up with them.
Stan, in the 50 or 60 years that you've been chasing this mystery, it seems like there's always a Menzel-type character, somebody who is the preeminent debunker of their time, who seemingly has stature and standing and a good reputation, who bashes, who sort of takes the forefront, takes the point in bashing the topic.
Yes.
You dug up the stuff on Menzel, and then later it seems like Phil Klass became the Donald Menzel of his era.
Yes, very much so. And remember that we have two people here with supposedly great reputations. Menzel was a professor of astronomy at Harvard, and how could you be any higher on the totem pole than that? Top university, and here's your top astronomer. And people may not be aware that he wrote three UFO books, anti-UFO books, and the first one in the 50s was translated into Russian. And you wonder, was there really that big a market for that? How did that happen? Who arranged for that, as an example? Klass, on the other hand, was younger, of course, than Menzel. And he was in a prime position. He became senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology, located in Washington. And he became sort of the go-to guy on the anti-UFO world. You needed a debunker to oppose people like me or anybody else who said that there's something to this. Go to Phil Klass. He's right there. And, you know, he's a fast typist. He's was a good writer. He's deceased, of course. But to illustrate his approach to things, I mentioned Majestic 12 before. He came out against one of the Majestic 12 documents. This is a group ostensibly set up by President Truman to deal with the reports which could affect national security. High-level group, six military, six civilian. Menzel was the surprise on the group. Everybody else we knew had a high-level security clearance, and it wasn't until years later that I found out that Menzel had. But when you look at Klass, you find he had every good reason to travel a great deal, which he did, to meetings in Europe and around the world. And to illustrate his approach to things, with regard to this Majestic 12, there was one of the documents that he said was obviously a fraud. It's a half a page of the Cutler-Twining memo. Bobby Cutler was Ike's national security advisor at the time. And he said it was obviously a fraud. Maybe I hadn't noticed that it was done in the large Pica type, when, as a matter of fact, the NSC, which is mentioned on the document, used only the small elite type. And he challenged me to provide any genuine documents, and he had a bunch of must-be things on it, you know, had to be signed and within a certain time frame and stuff like that. And he'd pay me $100 each for every genuine document done in the same size and style type, up to a limit of 10, unfortunately. And I looked at my files and immediately found 20 documents done in Pica type, so I had noticed that, but they didn't meet all his criteria. Only two did. When he agreed with that after I sent it to him. But I was going to the Eisenhower Library, and I got there, I found 14 that met all his criteria, made copies, sent him copies and an invoice for $1,000, and he paid me. Now, the strange part about this story is that I found out, because I asked, that Phil Klass had never been to the Eisenhower Library. They had 250,000 pages of NSC material, National Security Council material. Ike used the NSC more than Truman had. And so how could a legitimate journalist, and I'll ask you this, George, how could a legitimate journalist make that kind of a claim without even having looked at any of those documents? He got the 10, he did provide 10. He got them by mail. this is research? This is journalism? I don't think so. And he came on very strong. The kind of thing he would do, he and I would debate on a television program. Before we go in, they say, you can't bring anything in with you. I always like to bring these blacked out, whited out documents, stuff like that. But no, you can't bring anything with you. As soon as we get inside, Phil pulls a clipping out of his pocket, violates the instructions. That was typical of him. And in case after case, you find that his explanation simply doesn't hold water. Now, he was too smart a guy to be taken in easily. In other words, to say things that were totally wrong without knowing he was doing that. So you have the big question, and he challenged people, prove that he was taking money from any government agency. And I'm not saying he was, because I don't know if he was or not. I did find out this, though, that I mentioned the church committee before, that it turns out I talked to somebody at Aviation Week in Space Technology who had known Phil, and he mentioned to me that when they found that one of their people had been connected with the CIA, as revealed by the church committee, they fired him. So Phil would certainly have had to be extremely cautious about, you know, letting anybody know what he was doing and for whom and all the rest of that. But three anti-UFO books, many television and radio appearances, and never really doing an objective journalistic approach to the subject.
No, it was. I got to know him over the last couple of years of his life. I would correspond with him. We saw things very differently, but I figured, well, look, the guy's been around the topic for a long time. I'm going to be cordial in our exchanges for the heck of it. But it started much differently. As you lay out the story in the book about things he did to you and things he did to other researchers, it was pretty nasty. He showed up in Las Vegas out of the blue, asked if he could come on our newscast after I had done a couple of these talk shows with John Lear. And take whether you take what Lear says with a grain of salt or not, he had stirred up local interest in UFOs in the general topic.
Yeah.
And then Phil Klask just calls up, can I get on the air? And we had him on. And it was an interesting discussion. Later, I used excerpts from that interview in a documentary series that we produced. Phil Klask hit the roof. He tried to get me fired. He was writing to the general manager and wanted me gone. He thought I should be chastised and threatening lawsuits. And so it was pretty nasty there for a while. But that falls far short of what he did with you and others that you mentioned in the book, though.
Well, you mean like writing a letter to the National Research Council telling them that I was going to be there, a seller of baloney, in effect? I didn't know about that until many years later. And he didn't back up any of his claims. He just made wild claims. This was after I moved to Canada, and he knew I was moving to Canada. And so I didn't realize that you had that interaction with him, and I wonder how many others. We know the Hynek stuff. He wrote nasty letters to the FBI about Alan Hynek. You know, he wasn't really a scientist and blah, blah, blah. Extraordinarily strong, because the FBI had published an article by Alan, a mild article, actually, in effect saying to the FBI in one of their publications that, you know, why don't you guys pass these reports on to the Center for UFO Studies? Save you the trouble and difficulty and all that. We'd like to hear about them. And he ranted and raved about that to the FBI. The FBI, to its credit, and it's funny to read their responses to Klask, made clear to Phil Klask that they thought Hynek had an outstanding reputation. And they had tried to go after Klask for releasing classified data, but they couldn't do it because they'd had to declassify the classified data. And so I wonder how many more journalists have had encounters like you have had.
Well, you both address the issue of who was he working for, because for him to just show up in Las Vegas and as a rebuttal to John Lear, how did he get there? How did he know that was even happening? And he does that around the country. You, Kathy, you raise the issue in the book about whether or not he was working for anyone, and he sort of played games with that idea. You can check my tax returns. I've never received a paycheck. word games, really, word games.
That's true. Yes. Many people wrote to Philip Klass and accused him of working for a three-letter agency. And time again, he played a game with them where he would say, I will send you my tax returns for so many years as long as you will send yours to me. And nobody was willing to take him up on that. At one point, he did send his tax returns to somebody. He would always qualify what he said by saying, if I am telling the truth. So he would qualify that, which I found very interesting. It's in his correspondence files at the American Philosophical Society. And so it appears that he manipulated. He was a master manipulator in that he would set the stakes so high that no one could ever reach those stakes. And then at the same time, he would publicize the idea that no one had taken him up on this or no one could meet his demands. When he realized, and he even wrote in one of the letters that I read, that he intentionally had done this because he had no intention of ever paying anyone.
Well, he paid Stan. I think that might be the only time he ever did. Detail in the book how he went after Professor James McDonald, the things that he did to Travis Walton and to Betty Hill, I guess. You know, I think it maybe not only borders on character assassination, but goes over the edge. You know, in some regards, I think that he was beneficial to ufology in that he kept people on their toes. But man, some of the things he did were way over the line.
I
guess you were on the receiving end.
Yes, and he was a master character assassin. All the way back to Alan Hynek, for example, in Klass's FBI file, when he was furious because Hynek had written a paper, a well-researched scientific paper, that was in the FBI's law enforcement bulletin. Klass was furious and really was very rude to the FBI and accused them of endorsing a fraud, a hoaxer, the spiritual leader of kooks and cranks. And the FBI said that, you know, Alan Hynek had excellent credentials. He was highly respected in his field. And to that, Klass responded, he won't be for long. Klass went after not just the destruction of any evidence there was to support the idea that UFOs were real, but after the individuals themselves. He had attempted to destroy them through character assassination to cause them to lose their jobs. Poor Travis Walton was only 22 years old when Klass began his attacks on him. And one of the things that I wrote about in the book that I found extremely distressing is that Travis, when he was a teenager, 17 years old, was working in a factory. And he would spend cold winter nights with the factory owner's son, was a friend of the family. He would spend the night there.
I'll tell you what, Kathleen, we're going to have to stop there. The music is telling us we need to go to a break. We'll pick up that conversation. And then I want to ask, who is the Phil Klass of today? I want to get Stan's opinion on who Klass may have been working for, if anyone. Our friend, British superstar Robbie Williams, with the romantic song he did in 1998, She's the One, takes us into the break.